A whole lot of the global economy on the broadcast today. A story from the Great Recession as well. And clothes make the man, I guess. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is 15 August today. Good to have you along, everybody, as it always is. Item one as we get going, just to get this out of the way, ignore Wall Street today, will you? Stocks go down, too. That is the way it is supposed to work. Item two, the economic indicator du jour, retail sales for the month of July 2018. They were up from June 0.5%, which is pretty good. And I mention it because retail is one of those indicators that kind of hums along in the background most times. We pointed out today because the July number is one of the first big inputs into third quarter gross domestic product. That is overall economic growth, which is going to be real closely watched when it comes out this fall. We sit for Q2, as you remember, at 4.1%, a number of which much political hay has been made. All right, a little bit more now about the car company that's really a technology company whose CEO is looking for conservatively tens of billions of dollars to take it private. Elon Musk is the CEO. Tesla, of course, is the company. And the question we have been tossing around here at Marketplace World Headquarters is where the heck has Tesla's board been on this whole thing from Mr. Musk? Drew Harwell covers technology for The Washington Post. Drew, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do you suppose, and I understand this calls for some conjecture on your part, what do you suppose the conversations among Tesla board members right now are like?
I think there's some frustration that they're always having to clean up Elon Musk's mess. It's always been that Elon has driven the car of Tesla. He's always been sort of the visionary, and often that works out really well. I mean, they make great cars, but you know, when you're a board member, you want to have some predictability in the operation, especially when it comes to something that'll cost a couple tens of billions of dollars. It's hard to do that when you don't know what sort of information is going to be tweeted out in the middle of the night.
Well, and they have hired, I think, two law firms at last report to assist in whatever happens from here. This is not normal board CEO behavior, is it?
No, everything in this process has gone exactly backwards of what you would expect. You would expect there to be a lot of due diligence, a lot of lawyers and financial advisors behind the scenes getting this deal underway. And then at the end of this whole process, the CEO goes out on Twitter and says, hey, look what we've done. Elon went out first, made a huge show of having funding secured, and the board was quiet for about, I think, 30 hours or so before they put out their statement. Mm-hmm. You know, in this situation, we have Elon maybe talking first and thinking second. And we have the company sort of racing and scrambling to catch up. And, you know, that's clearly become a big issue for some investors. And I think it's becoming an issue for the directors, too.
Well, what does it say even that he came out with that $420 a share price? And all of us, me included, thought, no, he's making some pot joke here.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't gotten any sort of thinking behind the calculation of why 420, and clearly the pot joke is there. Elon loves these kinds of jokes, by the way. He named the cars of Tesla S, 3, X, and Y, which spells out sexy. So, you know, he has these.
But is that what you want from a CEO of a company who's trying to change the world? I mean, come on, man.
He's clearly got a huge army of fans because he does jokes like this. But yeah, I back on the 420 thing, I mean, the Saudi money that Elon says will swing in and save the day, none of them have said anything about how the 420 number came to be.
So spitball this for me, right? With reports today, so far anonymous sources, but reports today that the SEC has issued subpoenas, with the board having hired a couple of law firms, with no real idea of where the money's actually going to come from, now what happens?
What happens is a lot more people in suits get involved. Goldman Sachs is now financially advising Tesla. There's going to be lawyers and financial advisors for Elon, for the board, for the special committee. Everybody's going to staff up because this is a huge potential transaction. And we must remind that the board says they don't even have a formal proposal yet.
Yeah.
So we're still at the learning to crawl phase of this deal, and yet you can see all the movement. I think we'll probably see more from the SEC. It's a pretty obvious case to investigate when the chief says something, the stock bubbles up 11% in a day, mm-hmm. and there's been no sort of clear mm-hmm. due diligence or preparation ahead of that. Is this a case of fraud or stock manipulation? It's happened before by people. We don't know that that's what happened in this case, but you know, with that 9-word tweet, Elon opened Pandora's box here, and there's going to be a lot of questions to come.
Speaking of questions, we have, of course, called Tesla to see if they want to chat. Nothing from them yet. Drew Harwell covers technology at the Washington Post. Drew, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
With apologies to Charles Dickens, we're going to do a story now of what might be the global economy yet to come. And I'm going to set it up by telling you this. Russian officials were in Turkey yesterday, chatting with the government there about solutions to Turkey's currency crisis. Both countries, not coincidentally, have also been hit with American economic sanctions. So one idea they floated was not using the dollar, just not using it. Stick to their own currencies to trade with each other and so not have to deal with converting their rapidly falling rubles and liras. On top of that, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the U.S. is, and this is his word, abusing its role as a custodian of a global reserve currency. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains why the greenback is that and how realistic it is for now for countries to use another option besides the dollar.
Keeping a currency in reserve isn't just stockpiling cash. It's when a country holds on to assets in a particular currency, like India keeping U.S. Treasury bonds on hand in case the rupee market crashes. The dollar is also what's called an international currency, a common denomination for global business. Menzi Chin, an economist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, explains.
You can be an international currency where you're used in invoicing as well as trade, as well as being held as currency in the central bank.
He says the dollar is one of the few reliable currencies for that purpose, which is why George Selgin of the Cato Institute thinks this talk of ditching the dollar by Russia and Turkey is just saber-rattling.
Understandable saber-rattling, because it's certainly true that the Trump administration is using the dollar as a foreign policy weapon.
Because the Trump administration and most economists know this. There aren't a ton of other options for countries that want to move away from the dollar.
It's the worst currency except for the other choices.
But that doesn't mean it's unassailable. You know America's skyrocketing national debt? That can start to worry foreign investors, says Helen Popper, an economics professor at Santa Clara University.
If the federal government is borrowing too much, then people will be concerned about the long-term value of the dollar. And in that case, they will not want to hold dollars.
She says the dollar is not in real danger of losing its role as the primary global reserve, a more likely outcome that other countries might rebalance their holdings to be less dependent on the greenback. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Tomorrow's an anniversary of sorts, a year to the day since negotiations started on overhauling NAFTA, which 25 years after it went into effect is kind of long in the tooth. After a bit of a break, talks restarted today in Washington with a goal of overhauling President Trump's least favored trade deal by the end of the month. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, the negotiating teams have yet to meet a target date they did not blow past.
First, the three countries were hoping for a deal by last winter. Then this spring. The new target is the end of August, so Mexico's current president could sign the deal before his successor takes over in December.
Well, it's like six-dimensional chess now with a lot of unknowables.
Lori Wallach runs the Global Trade Watch Initiative at Public Citizen, an advocacy group.
Two different Mexican presidents, the incoming and the current, both have to agree on everything. And then it's unclear if Canada will sign on.
Because for the last month or so, Canada has been sitting on the sidelines while the U.S. and Mexico negotiate. Matt Gold is a law professor at Fordham University and former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative.
Right now, their main focus is on automotive rules of origin.
Really complicated rules about the share of parts and assembly work on cars that have to come from NAFTA countries. It's been one of the toughest issues on the table.
No one knows for sure what else they're talking about on a high level.
The fracture talks mean it's possible NAFTA might actually splinter into three separate deals, says Christopher Sands, director of the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Canada and Mexico could keep operating under existing NAFTA rules.
And then a MUFTA, which would be a Mexico-U.S. free trade agreement, CUFTA, Canada-U.S. free trade agreement. And the difficulty, of course, for business and investors is figuring out where the rules diverge and which rules apply.
San says after a year at the negotiating table, the countries have made some progress, but lots of issues and uncertainty remain. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Musta and Custa, never heard those before. Wall Street today, it wasn't just stocks on the wane, y'all. Crude oil closed down 3% in New York to $65.01 a barrel. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ten years ago this summer, we were in a lull of sorts between the bailout of Bear Stearns in March and the collapse of Lehman Brothers the third week of September. That financial crisis and the recession that followed changed this economy and the people in it in ways we are still figuring out. Our series on that topic is called How We Changed, and today's installment is a story of real estate. It comes from Weber J. Charles out of Miami, Florida.
For 3 to 5 years in South Florida, the real estate game was a free-for-all. It made a lot of people money, but if you didn't understand how real estate worked, you couldn't take advantage of that. In 2006, something came across my desk with some pretty cool financing options from Bank of America. They had a no money down 6% program for first-time homebuyers. So I found a place, 2-bedroom, a bike ride away from the beach. $179,000, this is doable. So I lived there for almost 2 years. In that span of time, things started to change. I was talking to Steve across the street, my neighbor, and he was like, yo, I just noticed that in a condo unit, the one right across from you, which is identically my unit, sold for $35,000. I'm freaking out. Some people were facing foreclosure because they couldn't pay. But there were a lot of people that did a strategic foreclosure, or what they would call a short sale. I was able to short sell the property for $35,000, and the difference was charged off my credit. In the aftermath and learning what was going on and reading, I was like, yo, I like completely missed the boat. I felt so deflated because I felt like I missed the boat. It's painful. Miami is a place where people want to be. I've lived here my whole life. The more attractive it gets, the more of a burden natives feel. There'll be a time where that space natives considered as their home won't exist. I think your typical Miami boy or Miami girl, they could stay here, but at the expense of being in a strong financial position. Our parents were able to do it for $600. Now we have to pay $4,000 a month to purchase a home. You can't even raise a family in some of these units. I don't know how you do it in Miami. I really feel like if I had to buy right now, it would not be in South Florida. You could love a city, but you know you can't let it kill you.
We've got a picture of Weber Charles on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, take a minute, would you? Let us know how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is HowWeChanged. Coming up,
we have fabrics with crushed diamond or crushed gold blasted into the wool as it's being woven.
No, seriously, they do. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, well, here you go. So it started bad, ended a little less bad. Dow Industrials off 137 today, 0.5%, closed at 25,162. The blue chips off 335 at one point. That was about 1%. NASDAQ down 96 points, 1.2%, 77.74. The S&P 500 off 21 points, 0.75%, ended at 28.18. Boeing flew down 0.2% today. Caterpillar down 0.2% as well. Heavy equipment maker Deere also 0.2%. Why on that magic number of 0.2%? Think global trade. Tesla slipped 2.5% on those reports as being subpoenaed by the SEC we told you about. General Motors charged down 0.7%. Ford gave back about 0.5%. In retail, Macy's down 15.9%. That despite posting better than expected quarterly sales and earnings and raising its full year guidance for the second day in a row. How come? Capitalism. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. And as you might know, I host a podcast with Molly Wood, Make Me Smart, it's called. This week, we dive into the constant dance of outrage and apology between social media companies and their users. You know, us. Make Me Smart. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We were telling you yesterday about Greece and how, come Monday next, the most heavily indebted country in the European Union will leave the relatively friendly financial confines of the bailout program that the International Monetary Fund and the EU set up back when things were looking really bad for Athens. Greece borrowed hundreds of billions of dollars at next to nothing interest rates, but now it's back to unbridled capitalism and whatever that might bring. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went to Athens to ask people how they're feeling about that.
Right now, we're going to cook our bread, which was proofed for 2.5 hours.
In his sandwich bar in central Athens, Nikos Voglis bakes bread for the next day's business.
The bread has to be sliced a little bit to get the yeast to open up as it cooks. Once we put it
toiling over the oven, Nikos himself gets rather heated when our conversation turns away from bread to the bailout exit.
Basically, what's happening is you're stopping borrowing money at 0.5%, and you're going to start borrowing money at 4.5%. I don't think it's something to have a party about. Come on.
Like many Greeks, Nikos doesn't believe the country has reformed itself sufficiently to go it alone.
We have not completed what we had to do here to become a free market economy.
In fact, the creditors don't seem to think so either. First of all, they've lent Greece an extra $25 billion so that it doesn't have to resort to the financial markets immediately. And they've required the country to stick to a very strict program of austerity, reform and big budget surpluses that could last for more than 40 years. This all adds up to a continuing heavy burden of taxation for the Greeks, even after bailout exit. Dr. Dimitris Papadimitriadis is an Athens-based psychiatrist.
70% of my earnings go to the government.
70%.
That's correct. So you see there that there is still a frustration about how things will evolve.
Throughout the crisis, some 500,000, mostly young Greeks, left the country, a big loss of human capital. In spite of the bailout exit, that exodus seems likely to continue, at least if Effi Panoutsakopoulou, a bank worker, is anything to go by. She's already preparing her two young sons, aged 11 and 8, for emigration.
I'm starting to tell them that they eventually have to leave Greece and go somewhere else to live or to study or to work.
You really think there's no future for them here?
No, I don't think so.
The International Monetary Fund's solution to the Greek malaise is wholesale debt cancellation. The IMF says the country cannot hope to prosper unless a big chunk of the third of $1 trillion its government owes is written off. But apart from deferring some repayments, the Eurozone creditors, especially the Germans, don't want to go along with that. Some Greeks believe the answer lies much closer to home. This satirical stage show was a big hit here 1 year after the crisis began. The show ridiculed the Greeks for lacking foresight and discipline. Co-producer Yanis Sarkatsanis says if he were putting on the same show today, he wouldn't change a thing.
I think it would be exactly the same message. Nothing has changed.
The crisis, he says, has been one of values. Too many Greeks dodge taxes, evade rules and vote for pork barrel politicians because they think it would be dumb to do otherwise.
You never want to be the malakas, as we say, because whenever you follow a rule and someone else doesn't, you feel like a malakas.
Malakas means jerk.
And that's like the worst fear, the worst thing that can happen to you in Greece.
But he says the real jerks were the many dodgers, evaders and rule breakers who drove Greece into debt and disaster.
The day we Greeks understand that, then that will be the day that the crisis ends.
But that, he says, is unlikely to be next Monday, August the 20th, bailout exit day. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We started with retail. We are going to end on retail, specifically how it's changing as data and technology and consumer finickiness becomes more part of the landscape. Colin Hunter is the CEO and co-founder of a men's clothing retailer called Alton Lane, which uses data and technology and, honestly, the idea that clothes shopping isn't most men's idea of a good time to find an edge. Colin, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Give me the elevator pitch for this thing, would you?
Yeah, so we are an upscale menswear brand that is all about making shopping less painful for men.
I'm in, right there, I'm in.
Perfect.
Tell me, though, why you felt you needed to do this. I mean, give me the business model. Give me the, you know, your advantage in the marketplace, if you will, and then tell me why.
Yeah, you know, it's really quite simple. When we looked out at the menswear space, we saw this multi-billion-dollar global industry that wasn't taking into account this basic truth that we all know, that most men hate to shop, but every guy still wants to look good. Hmm. And so we said, let's actually break down the industry and build it back up the way that makes sense for the consumer and doesn't necessarily make sense for the fashion industry. So all of our stores are private one-on-one appointments. You have a dedicated style expert working with you. We have full bars, flat screen TVs, secret rooms. We utilize 3D body scanning technology to capture over 300 measurements in about 30 seconds. And what that does is it allows our tailors around the world to actually see your body when they're creating your garments. And it delivers a better fit than what you might find somewhere else.
And I can't be the first guy to say this to you. It sounds a little bro-y and man-cave-y.
I think it doesn't when you go into our space.
All right.
You know, all the components that I'm talking about, good lighting, great drinks, you would expect that at – you could expect that in a bar. You could expect that at a super high-end hotel.
What you're offering here then clearly is a high-end product.
It is a high-end product, but we start at accessible price points, and that was really important to us. Our custom shirts start at $99. Our custom suits start at $600. With that said, we never want customers to have to graduate from our brand. And so you can get a suit that's $10,000 from us and that has we have fabrics with crushed diamond or crushed gold blasted into the wool as it's being woven. It's not a cheap product. We view it as an investment.
Fair enough. I'm a public radio guy, and $600 sounds like, you know, it sounds like a lot for a suit, but I wear, you know, khakis and a t-shirt to work every day.
Sure.
Once you get me scanned and whatever in that booth, and then you have my orders and in theory, you know where I work and I live because you're going to mail it to me, it occurs to me you have a whole lot of data about me.
That's right.
How worried ought I be?
Not worried at all in terms of privacy. We take the privacy of our clients very seriously. We view data as a mechanism to improve the customer experience. I might shop at a store like J. Crew 18 times over the past few years, you know, picking up things here or there. Every time I walk into that store, it's as if I'm a brand new customer. Hmm. So for us, we want to use that data, not just your measurements and your style preferences, but your demographic data. Do you travel for work all the time? And therefore, let's really show you fabrics that don't wrinkle.
Is this a retail clothing company or is it a technology company?
I view us more as an experience company that's powered by data and technology. It doesn't have to stop at clothing. We've made recommendations for honeymoons, for trips, for restaurants, and we're even able to kind of see different trends of like-for-like customers within a city, within different neighborhoods, across various cities. There's some really interesting things that we can do down the road.
So I'm right. That data is a powerful thing.
Absolutely.
Colin Hunter, he's the CEO and co-founder of a technology and clothing and experiential company called Alton Lane. Colin, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We had to leave some stuff on the cutting room floor, as we usually do with these interviews. You can hear those bits, including what a trade war and textile tariffs are going to do to Colin Hunter's global supply chain, on our Corner Office podcast. final note on the way out today, in which Twitter effectively tells conspiracy theorist Alex Jones to go stand in a social media corner for a week. His account has been put in what's called read-only mode for 7 days. Twitter was, until last night, the only big social media company not to fine Jones in violation of its rules. The straw that broke the camel's back, apparently, was Jones tweeting a video in which he told his supporters to, and this is a quote, get their battle rifles ready. Other things Mr. Jones has said that didn't violate Twitter's terms include falsely saying the school shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary were a hoax. I had a really good discussion of this whole issue, by the way, of private companies being arbiters of public speech on the latest episode of the podcast that Molly Wood and I do. It's called Make Me Smart, available in all the usual places podcasts are available. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 137 today, 0.5% mild for what it could have been. NASDAQ down 96 points, 1.2%. S&P 500 off 21, 0.75%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.